Inside Gene.
Good evening, fellow nitpickers in the philosophical navel of man.
Hey, George, that's kind of nice.
Oh, yes, indeed. I kind of like that. You heard me tell the story about the navel lint collected, didn't you? Of course. We're all in one way or another in this same boat. That's why that story is so elegant in its cutting down to the marrow of life. True thing. In fact, I've been getting letters recently. You know, you get these letters. One letter said, "Shepherd, what was your first experience in public broadcasting?" Now, you didn't ask me my first experience in showbiz. That's different. Oh yes, showbiz. I'll tell you, my first experience in showbiz came in second grade. I was in second grade. And we had the second grade teacher, and Miss Shields. And Miss Shields, as part of a PTA, they had a PTA weekend where all the parents came to school and all that stuff, and they had the displays of various artworks that the kids had made and all that. Her contribution to this was an oral hygiene pageant, which was performed on Saturday night on that weekend. And I took part in that. I played a decayed molar. Yes. And, of course, of typecasting all the way down the line because other kids, the more clean-limbed types, I remember Eileen Akers, for example, played a toothbrush. She played a toothbrush, and Helen Weathers played a tube of toothpaste. And there were other various characters. One guy played a malocluded bite. Jack Morton played that. I remember all our rehearsals, and I can recall that feeling walking out on the stage. I had a tooth suit on. We spent at least 2 weeks in second grade making these, you know, the costumes. It was a big process of all the kids getting to make them. And the way we made the teeth was very interesting, I thought. Already I was beginning to be aware of the tinsel, the glamour, and the false world of showbiz. We made these teeth out of wire. We had pieces of wire which were made into circles, and they were then covered like a Japanese lantern with paper, which was then painted white, and I had this big brown-black spot painted on the top, and that was my decayed place. And I had these two little holes where I could see out, and it had the beautiful roots. This tooth had roots down there that concealed my feet. And I remember walking out on the stage, and I heard this audience, you know, there's such a beautifully done decayed molar, and I was playing it so well. I was an instinctive performer at that point, because you see, after all, a decayed molar, one has to understand the role one's playing. One doesn't just walk out, you know, with the same elan, the same spirit, if you were playing, say, a healthy incisor. That's a tooth that's stepping forward confidently into the future. You must admit that a decayed molar is a tooth that has some doubts about its future, right? More than that, it's a tooth that has been assailed and attacked by unkind germs. So I came out with this slight limp. I thought about the part for a couple of days, and I worked it out. I came out with a slight limp and a faint but barely audible moan. As I moved around on the stage. And, of course, it was a very effective performance. And that was my first experience with showbiz. We're not here to talk about that, though. We're dealing with something else here. I was bitten by the showbiz bug later on in the same year. Due to my fantastic performance as a decayed molar, I played George Washington in a George Washington birthday drama, which was performed in an auditorium session at the Warren G. Harding School. And this entire drama was played after the whole performance took place in a very important but highly unknown part of Mr. Washington's life. This is after he had retired from public life. This drama was written by our third grade teacher, Miss Robinette, and I was cast in the role of George, unexpectedly, but of course, at that time, still, with the child's lack of knowledge of his true talent, I did not realize why they asked me to do it. Later, I began to realize that I don't think there's anyone in the whole school could have pulled off a Washington like I pulled off, but it was a good, solid performance. Nothing spectacular, but solid, meaningful, with great insight into the man's character, Washington. Well, this drama took place on the front porch of Mount Vernon. So when the curtain went up, there I was sitting in a rocking chair, looking right out at the audience, wearing a wig made out of tufts of white cotton that Miss Robinette made by gluing them onto a stocking cap made from a lady's stocking. You know, the kind you pull her in. They glued all this over. And it came down over my ears. It was really very, very effective. It had a little pigtail in the back. It was a white thing. And I had a little blue vest, and I was wearing silver buttons that had been glued, made out of tinfoil. This is the way the showbiz is. Nothing is real in showbiz. So we took little round pieces of cardboard and glued tinfoil from Hershey bars on them. And these were glued to my little vest, which made it look like I was wearing silver buttons. We then took a pair of patent leather shoes, put Vaseline on them to make them shine, and then cardboard buckles were cut out that were covered with tin foil, and there I sat out there with the white stockings on, wearing a pair of corduroy knickers that had been dyed black. Very elegant costume, you can see that. Think of it yourself. Had a white shirt on, and I was sitting on the porch, the elderly, the ancient figure of the father of our country, rocking and being philosophical to his wife. And I'll ask the class now at this point, what was George Washington's wife's name? That's correct. It was Martha. Do any of you know Thomas Jefferson's wife's name? Now, that's a harder one. Now, in the case of this performance, when the curtain went up, and I heard this gasp of the audience as I sat there and rocked, and next to me was Esther Jane Albury, who was dressed as Mrs. Washington. Now, remember, this was in the twilight of the great man's career, and he was talking back over the things. He was talking to her. I remember the opening line was, "Martha, are you awake?" And she was supposed to say, "Yes, George." And at that point, I said the following speech, which I still remember. You're interested in the early days of the theater. At that point, I said, "Martha, I have been sitting here going back over my remembrances as the father of our country, and the things which I see in the future for our great land, and the things which I look back with pleasure as we have created this great land out of the wilderness." And at which point she was supposed to say, "That's very, very nice, George. I am so proud that they call you the father of our country. Would you please tell me what your remembrances are?" Well, we started the play, and the curtain went up, and I said the opening line, "Are you awake, Martha?" See, at that point, she started to talk, but I could not hear her. We had not ever had a dress rehearsal. All of our rehearsals had been undress rehearsals. The first time I wore the wig, nobody stopped to think that with the wig down over my ears, I could not hear Martha speaking to me. Well, you would think ordinarily this would be a fiasco. It was not a fiasco. I plowed right ahead, again showing the basic innate talent of a talented performer in the theater. I plowed right on ahead, and I delivered the entire play. Now, the play took roughly, if it were performed properly, about 12 minutes. Had it figured out. Well, since we did not at this point then have any use for Martha's lines, the play took about 7.5 minutes. I went right through it. And with a thunderous applause, the curtain went down, and Esther Jane started to cry. But who the hell cares about one's fellow performers on a night of triumph, right? Now, all right, now let's get down to the basic point here of contention. My first moment when I discovered the thrill, the excitement, the unbelievable joy of broadcasting over the electronic media. Now, you hear stage people constantly talk about, you know, getting the audience reaction to stage performances, and I have done a lot of stage work here in New York and around, as you know, and that is a certain thrill. There is no question about it. And in fact, you know, playing on the stage at Carnegie Hall is nothing quite like it, friends, really, I mean it. However, may I say this, the curious, almost mystic feeling that one gets performing in the electronic media is unique in itself. You ever hear anybody talk about this? You know, you always hear an elegant stage actor say, "Yes, the audience is seeing, and I believe that," you know, that's true for them. And it's true when I play audiences. That's a whole different thing. But the curious, mystical, strange, magnetic experience of communicating via magical means. It's really magic, really, in a way. I'm talking here into a little piece of metal here. And you're sitting out somewhere, you can be up in Nova Scotia hearing me. Now, that's in its own way, it's magic. Very, very magical. Do you agree, Herb? That's a magical experience. Now, when you're standing on a stage and you're saying something, and you see those people down there, and they're listening to you, that's not magical. That's a pure, you know, they're just watching you pretend to be something. Now, you can create a magical atmosphere in the theater, but the medium itself is not magical. It's very down to earth. I mean, let's face it, standing up on a stage wearing a tooth costume and everybody sitting there watching you pretend you're a tooth, this is a, you know, it's a pure physical act. But the magic of somebody squatting in the middle of a hovel somewhere in Staten Island with a $3 radio hearing you talk. This is another piece of metal. He's just got a chunk of metal and plastic. That's all that is. There it is, a magical process. And then even more interesting, they'll take this off on tape, and they will play this years later. I will hear parts of some performance I've done years ago suddenly appear on a radio station somewhere. This is not true in the Broadway theater. It's just something that doesn't happen. You know, it's curious magic to this thing, and it's definite. Now, how did this first happen with me? Well, I'll tell you. A combination of things. One thing that happened was purely accidental. Completely, it was an accidental, and I might say that it also a very, more than accidental, I would say highly pivotal in my life. I think most people's profession and whatever it is that they, unless they're born into a family of 17 generations of horse doctors or something like that, you know, the fact that you may become the 18th generation of horse doctors is not necessarily accidental, but most people do not come from a long line of whatever it is they do. You know, not really, it's fact. I mean, can you imagine this little guy ducking in and out of a phone booth on 48th Street? He comes from a long line of seven generations of phone booth Indians. Spend all their life scrabbling in and out of phone booths, making cockamamie calls. Well, this is part of our lives. We got the accidental part, and here's what the accidental part was. All right, I had a paper route. That was the first thing. Went into it. See, well, a lot of kids had paper routes at school, right? And I had a paper route. I had this bike, and every morning I would get up at about 4 o'clock in the morning. I delivered both the morning paper and the evening paper, which was one hell of a job to develop, you know, to deliver both of them. So I'd get up about 4 o'clock in the morning, and I'd go down to the place where they had the papers, down at George's candy store, and they had all these papers piled. He had the concession there, and all the papers, and so me and about 9 other paper boys would squat around on the floor in the dawn, and roll up our papers and stick them in these big sacks. I carry 2 big cloth sacks, and on one side it said Chicago Tribune. That was the paper I delivered, Chicago Tribune. And kind of a heavy paper, big paper. It was a big one, like the Times. And I'd pack these babies away, and I'd go struggling out into the wind with 2 big sacks of Chicago Tribunes on my back. And as I would slowly get rid of them, around the route that I had, I would move faster and faster. And then by the time I would be finished, which was usually about 7:30, I was ready to go to school. See, school started at 8 o'clock or 8:15, something like that. And I'd already put in a good day by the time I, you know, got into Miss Robinette's class. But nevertheless, it was that particular job that did it. This first moment, there was a whole lot of people I'd deliver these ads, these papers to. See, and every day I would deliver them in the morning. And I'd never see these people hardly ever in the morning. They were always asleep. You know, I'd come riding past and wham, I'd flip that paper up on a porch. Now, I had all kinds of techniques on how to throw papers after you're doing it for a while. That becomes an art form in itself. You know, you ever stop to think that almost everything you do in life, you get to be a specialist if you do it enough? Have you ever watched a really good elevator man stop an elevator that's going about 100 miles an hour right exactly on the floor? Yeah, try that sometime. You think that's easy. Have you ever seen a guy back a semi-tractor up to a loading dock between two other trucks? That's something to watch. You know, a gigantic 5,000-foot trailer. You know, he backs this baby up. Man, I mean, you don't think that's talent. You ought to try it. Half the people can't even back up their Volkswagen. Much, you know, it's sad. But nevertheless, throwing papers up on the porch as you're riding full tilt on an Elgin bicycle pursued by seven Airedales in the middle of a driving crosswind takes a talent of a high order, and it took me about 3 months to learn how to really do this. You see, because there's various types of throws. Some places have a hedge in front, at which point it's the overhand flip, like so, you know, right over, and you'd hear the, once in a while, you'd hear the heart-filling, soul-satisfying crash as, as your paper went through a front door or something like that. But generally, what we aim for were the eaves. We love to throw them into the drain pipe up at the top there. See, that was always fun. That was always good, especially if you could put it in on one shot, not on a rebound, just shoop, bump, right into the drain pipe. That was really... Occasionally, we'd try all kinds of special things. Like, I used to love to throw, whenever there was a bucket or something on the front porch, I used to try to score points, you know, you bounce them off the backboard, you know, hit it a bucket there. Well, all right, on Saturday now... This is not the point of the story, how to deliver papers. On Saturday, I would go around and collect, right? Okay. Well, there was one strange, mysterious house on my route. And this house, this is an ordinary frame house. But this house always had funny noises coming out of it. I'd hear these noises all the time. And I'd come up to the front porch there to collect, and I'd ring the bell, and always this man would come out. See, this man, he's always looking harassed, see. And he said, well, how much is it? He'd say, he's always in a hurry, and I could hear these noises coming from behind. Right, uproar, always in the house, all kinds of whistles and stuff. And he'd say, how much is it? And I'd say, 27 cents. He'd say, all right, okay, I'll be right with you. He says, here's 30 cents. Don't worry about the pennies. And he'd rush into the house and go. Well, one day, I'm about 10. One day, I come up to this guy's house, and I ring the doorbell. I can hear the uproar coming out. And he opens the door, and he says, how much is it? He always ever asks the same. He said, 27 cents. And he says, well, I've only got a dollar. I don't have enough change. Well, all right, come on in, for crying out loud. And I come in the house, first time I'm in the house, see? And I'm looking around, and I'm standing there waiting, and he's going through the cookie jars or something for 27 cents. And I look into the room where all this noise is coming out. I can't believe what I'm seeing. There's this fantastic big panel went all the way to the ceiling with the glowing meters, and everything is going. And out of this, there was a loudspeaker, and there was all kinds of stuff, and it's going, I'll say, fantastic uproar. And there's a microphone. And I'm looking in there with my eyeballs bulging. Obviously, this guy saw that I was fascinated. He came out of the kitchen with the money, and he says, here's your 27 cents. And I said, what is that? He said, well, it's an amateur radio. It's an amateur radio station. And I said, oh, really? He said, yeah, you want to take a look at it? Well, you know, all hams are always that way. They always want to show you their thing. See, so I didn't know it at the time, but I was entering an entire new world.
I walked into this guy's room, and it's, you know, radio equipment all over, fantastic stuff. He's got a microphone. And he comes back, he turns a switch, and he says, something like a W3HRC, 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 and this is W9JZA, are you still there? Boom. And back comes his voice, W9JZA, this W3HRC, just hanging on here. I didn't know what happened here, Gil. And with that, Gil goes back on. He says, oh, well, I said, the kid came here with the papers. I had a QRX for a couple of minutes here while I got the paper money. And I'm standing there with my eyeballs. This guy, he's talking to somewhere. I figured, you know, he's in the next room or something. Well, I discovered he was not. He was in some place like Harrisburg, Pennsylvania. And Gil, who was the guy that was the guy who I was delivering the papers to, I didn't know him as Gil. You know, he was Mr. Columbus, you know, very official type. He says, say hello to Howie. That's Howie, W3HRC. Say hello to Howie there. And, you know, I'm looking at this. He gives me this microphone, which I now recognize incidentally as a D104, in case you're interested. He hands me the mic, saying, oh, you know, he says, well, say something to him. Hello, Howie. Hi, Howie. How are you, Howie? At which point Gil takes the mic and says, well, what'd you say your name was, kid? Oh, that was Gene. Yeah, that's Gene. Well, okay, Howie. Turn it back to you now. I hope the QRM isn't too tough on us now. So I'll just turn it back here in a minute. You can say hello to the visitor in the shack. And by the way, you were peaking over about 9:05 on that last transmission. We must be getting a pretty good path here. You're coming through great. So, okay, I'll turn it back. This W9JZA, turn it over to W3HRC. And boom. And this voice comes back on. Hello, Gene. How are you? Boy, you sure sounded good on that. Is this your first experience with amateur? I was done. My God. I mean, you know what I'm talking about, since you're a ham too. See, well, from that minute on, I mean, there was no turning back. I mean, but I never thought in terms. I always thought in terms of building equipment, you know, being in the air. The next turning point came, and there I was. I was bitten by the microphone. The next turning point came. Now, I am a junior in high school. Okay, you got that? And I'm playing on the high school football team. This was a big high school, 3,000 students. And this was about the second or third game into the season. And I got a very badly pulled muscle in my left leg. I'm telling you, I had a... have you ever really pulled a muscle, any of you out there? Well, if you played football or baseball, you probably have at one time or another, if you played it seriously. Well, I want to tell you, I pulled a muscle. Sometimes it still hurts. How did it happen? Well, just like it always happens, in the middle of a play, I turned and made a bad turn, bad cut or something, and I felt something go, and all of a sudden I was rolling around on the ground with my muscle and my calf bunched up, and I was really in action for about 3 or 4 weeks after that little goody. I hate to play football in the rain because this is where you really get hurt in rain, because you first of all, your cleats always slide, and it's obvious, you know, you have problems. Also, you have trouble with visibility, too. In a rainstorm, the rain is coming down, you don't quite have that sharpness. Your peripheral vision is cut down. And, man, that's a way to get a blindside shot that doesn't stop. So, anyway, there I am. See, I got this fantastic leg, and I'm hobbling around. I got ace bandages all over me, you know, and they're giving me the heat treatments and stuff. So I came down, it was a big night, a game. We're sitting down there. We're playing Roosevelt High School. Again, this was a historic moment in my life. I'm not even suiting up tonight because of this thing. See, I love this. So I was going to go down and sit on a bench, see. And so we're sitting in the dressing room, and everybody's suiting up, and I've got the ace bandages all over my leg. When this guy comes in, and he's talking to the coach. I just see the guy. He's some civilian-type guy. And the coach comes over to me and says, hey, Shepard. He said, listen, he said, would you care to go up in the booth and do a little spotting for the guys on the radio? I said, what? He said, yeah, I said, yeah, because all our games were broadcast on a local radio station, see. And he says, would you like to go? You know, I'd never even gone up there, so knew what they did or anything. All I know is that everybody heard the games on the broadcast, you know, every week. They would hear them on the radio. So he says, would you like to go up and do a little spotting? So I said, yeah, you know, sure.
He said, "Well, okay, go with him. This is Frank. Frank, this is..." And one guy is the broadcaster. See, and they have two microphones there. And he's sitting there, and they had these... I always remember these microphones, and I don't even know what kind they were, but they were bullet-shaped. I remember that was impressed me, see. So this guy's sitting there doing the show during the... I remember his name even, John something. So he was the guy that was doing the broadcast. And they were not even on the air yet. So he says, "Hi, my name is John Watanabe." When he says, I do the play-by-play here. I heard him, so he's a famous guy, you know. Wow, you know. I said, "Hello." He said, "Oh, yeah, Shepard, I've seen you play." And he said, "Boy, well, how's your leg?" So I said, "Oh, man, you know, it's okay." And then he said, "Well, sit down over there." He said, "If you want to do it." He said, "Hey," he said, "would you like to," he said, "would you like to do a little color for us?" I said, "What? What? I mean, what the hell color is?" He said, "Well, would you like to do a little color?" I know. I can get some. Sits there and listen. Yeah, when he's talking on the phone, then he says, "5 seconds." And then he gives him the finger. See, boom, like that. And the guy says, "Hello, ladies and gentlemen. Hello, sport fans everywhere. Tonight's big game between Hammond and Roosevelt High School. Going to come to you in about 10 minutes. We've got a fantastic crowd out here tonight." And he's talking away there, seeing at the gym. Look at the guy. He's fantastic. See, well, I'm sitting over here to his right. And there was another microphone there, and sitting in front of the microphone was this other guy, the guy that had come down into the dressing room who brought me up. See, I didn't even know who he was. He says, "And tonight we have Howie Johnson here to give the color for you. How does the game look to you, Howie?" And Howie says, "Well, it looks like it's going to be a good ball game." He said, "I'll tell you this, this rain is going to change things a little bit tonight. We don't expect a lot of passing tonight. We're going to see some fumbles. I expect to see they're going to have a lot of trouble keeping a handle on the ball. And what do you think about that, Shepard? We have up here in the booth here, we have Shepard, who, as you know, plays on the offensive team for Hammond High. We'd like to talk to Shepard here for a minute. He's up here, he's got an injured leg. And what do you think of tonight's game?" What the hell? Here I am. Tonight's game. I wanted to ask them all about this, you know, what they're doing there. See, I said, "Well, tonight's game. I believe that that's a pretty good ball club. I only played once against Roosevelt. A pretty good club. I'll say this: they probably got one of the best defensive lines in the league." Turk Mazursky, I'll tell you, he's this guy. You got to watch Mazursky. If Mazursky is on down there on the defensive left tackle, I mean, he's what it's about in that line down there. And if Mazursky's on, you're going to see a lot of guys having trouble tonight in our backfield. And I believe it's going to be a good game. He said, "Well, thank you very much, Shepard. Stick around now. We'd like to have you give a few comments as the ball game develops. Since you're part of the offensive club down there, now let's go back to John, and we're about ready for the play-by-play to begin. I see they're lined up down there for the kickoff. John, take it over." And John says, "Well, okay, ladies and gentlemen, now they're lining up. Hammond High is elected to receive. They won the toss, and there's a slight rain coming down now, but it looks like it might pick up a little bit later on, which is going to change the course of the ball game. They're lining up now, and the kicker, let's see who it is. It's Gualiak for Roosevelt High. He's a pretty fair kicker. He keeps them high. And they're lining up, and they're sweeping up now for the kick. And there's the kickoff. And it's taken by Papis, 5 yards behind the line, 5 yards behind the goal line. He's up to the 5, 10, 15, and he's down at the 18-yard line. That was very interesting. Shepard, does Papis usually line up like that on the, you know? I said, "What?" I said, "Well, yeah, you know, that's our number four. Kickoff formation. Papis lines up like that, sometimes off to the right and deep." And you notice we had Fred Holinka was up around the 5-yard line. We only use one safety, but he's a canted safety. He plays off because we know this guy slants his kicks usually off to the left. And he said, "Oh, very interesting. That was all right. Now let's get back to the play-by-play. Now they're lining up the 18-yard line. Holinka's calling the plays now. And it's a handoff to, let's see, that was, what was that? That was Clevenger. Yes, Clevenger takes the ball up to the 21-yard line. A direct shot through left tackle. A straight-ahead play." Sounds familiar, doesn't it? Well, you know, it never hit me about the reality of this thing. I was just enjoying this, you know, talking about this stuff. And that the game is now over. Curious, we won 21-6.
And after the game, he's saying, well, thank you very much for being our guest tonight. It's been a pleasure to have you. And now let's take a look at the statistics for tonight's game. And he waves bye-bye, you know, so long. So I go hobbling down. I get down into the dressing room, and sitting in the dressing room was Mr. Wilson, who was our assistant coach. And he's looking like he's about to, you know, he's got this like his head is made out of black clouds, and he's mean looking. And always a very, he says, oh, smart ass, all right, Shepherd. I says, what? He says, what was all this? We're sitting here in the equipment room listening to you on that bride. What do you mean by saying that the left side of our offensive line is the weak side? What is this stuff? What are you coming out here talking like that on the air for? You realize that tomorrow, next week already, probably Washington, is already setting up a whole offense based on what you were saying the other day. What is this? It never hit me that people were listening. And that night, when I went home, my brother, my mother, everybody in the neighborhood said, we heard you on the radio. Suddenly hit me. The guy who's doing the game is bigger than the guy who's playing the game. Hardly anybody said, hey, wow, boy, was Papus really, man, there was some real running going on. No, they said, hey, boy, I heard you on the radio. I go in the drugstore. Hey, man, I heard you on the radio. I've been playing for 3 years, and nobody ever said anything. Let's face it, out at Yankee Stadium, Phil Rizzuto gets a bigger hand than Roy White. Vince Scully goes on. Dodgers come and go. Do you agree? Red Barber is a bigger star than Carl Furillo ever was. Are you going to argue that? Are you going to try to tell me that Mel Allen wasn't bigger than, say, Ralph Terry, who won a lot of games for the Yankees? Hardly anybody remembers Ralph Terry, but everybody, Mel Allen, oh, yeah, I remember Mel Allen, of course. Sure. Yes, Walter Cronkite is far bigger than the president to most people. Sure, you know, presidents come and go. But Walter Cronkite goes on. Hardly anybody today can remember the name of astronauts. I can remember a few of the very early astronauts. Maybe John Glenn. That's about it. But boy, oh boy, a lot of people believe seriously that the space program was created, put into motion, designed, and set off by Walter Cronkite. If not Walter Cronkite, at least John Chancellor. And I discovered a basic fact of life. Nobody had ever said, hey, Shepherd, boy, what a block. That was a fantastic block. Man, that block, you guys sprang him, you know? You and Berlioz. No. Nobody ever gives anybody any credit for a block. Nobody ever gives anybody a credit, you know, for running interference. But if you're up there blabbing about it, you'll be given credit for everything. Everything. If it's a win, my God. I mean, it was, it was Kurt Gowdy. He really, really pulled it off. This Howard Cosell, you know, are you trying to tell me that Howard Cosell isn't a bigger star than Tom Seaver? You trying to tell me that? Are you trying to tell me that Howard Cosell isn't a bigger star than George Blanda? Than Joe Namath? Oh, of course. Let's face it, man. Today, it's the wrapping that people buy, not the cereal. Yes. The guy that talks about it is bigger than the guy that does it. Clive Barnes is bigger than any star on Broadway today. You better know it, friends. You better, and he knows it too.
By recording from New York, you've been listening to Inside Gene Shepherd. Our next Shepherd program can be heard at 7 o'clock Wednesday evening. Right now, it's 23 minutes before 8 o'clock. Our temperature is 56 degrees. And in tonight's news, the first contingent of the Palestine Liberation Organization has arrived in New York City for the start.